Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
He always took the Bible for his guide, and he liked little boys to walk by his side. He preferred their company more so than men, because he knew there was less guile in them. And in his conversation he was modest and plain, denouncing all pleasures he considered sinful and vain, and in battle he carried no weapon but a small cane, whilst the bullets fell around him like a shower of rain. He burnt the debtors' books that were imprisoned in Khartoum, and freed them from a dismal prison gloom, those that were imprisoned for debts they couldn't pay, and sent them rejoicing on their way.
Beautiful, Tom. Absolutely beautiful reading of a brilliant poem.
Thank you very much. Further verses there from William McGonagall's great poem, marking the death of General Gordon at Khartoum in 1885. And Dominic, in the first part, we were looking at the first part of Gordon's career, up to the point where he goes to the Sudan for the first time. So he's a great hero. He's the Chinese Gordon, he's called. He spent 6 years in Gravesend helping helping the Wangs, the little boys who were mentioned in that yeah. poem there.
Yeah.
And if you think that's suspicious, well, you can hear our discussion of that in yesterday's episode if you haven't already. So Dominic, so February 1874.
Yes.
What's going on?
So there's this extraordinary situation in the Sudan, basically. So Egypt, which is nominally part of the Ottoman Empire, but de facto kind of isn't, is pretty much, it has the Sudan almost as a kind of a possession of its own. But in turn, Egypt is kind of answering to Britain because it owes Britain loads of money. So what you have in the Sudan is that the Sudanese economy, the Sudan is incredibly poor. The Sudanese economy depends largely on slavery. So the slavery is being abolished all over the world and the slave trade being stamped out. The East African slave trade is still going very strong. In fact, it's arguably stronger than ever because slavery has been stamped out elsewhere. So there's loads of money to be made from slavery. And the Khedive of Egypt, the ruler of Egypt, I think basically uses the sort of anti-slavery sentiment. He says, well, I want to stamp out slavery too. Actually, what he really wants is to reassert his control over the Sudan. And what he wants to do is to get somebody in, an outsider, a Brit, to come and run the Sudan for him and impose control, set up a whole trading network. And the Khedive says, I'd like you to stamp out the slave trade as well.
So it's a bit, perhaps,
yeah,
like the Iraqi exiles from Saddam Hussein's regime going to American neoconservatives and saying, Would you please come and kick out Saddam?
I suppose that's it's a slight stretch, but I can see what you're saying. It's basically, yes, it's getting an outsider into it.
So we've done an episode on 9/11. We've done an episode on Napoleon in Egypt. And this is kind of midway between that. But we are now moving into the very, very contested, complex and very ambivalent history of the relationship of the West to Islam.
That's right. I mean, the whole slavery issue, right? I mean,
yeah, well, so... absolutely, because the impetus for anti-slavery is Christian. It's absolutely powered by exactly the kind of experience of being born again, of evangelical certitude that Gordon has also bought into.
So Gordon is passionately opposed to slavery. I mean, basically, for the second half of his life, he spends all his time thinking about how he'd love to be a crusader against slavery and stamp it out and so on. And that means he ends up being used, or almost used, by a succession of quite dodgy people. So well, one of them is the Khedive, and later on, Leopold II, Belgian in the Congo, who wants to use Gordon as a tool, with anti-slavery being the pretext.
And elements within British foreign policy establishment and military establishment as well. Yeah. Because one of the paradoxes of Britain's absolutely key role in the abolition of the slave trade, which is done for overtly moralistic reasons. I mean, I say overtly, I mean, they are done for moral reasons. It's forced through and led and conducted by people who passionately believe that they're doing God's will. But that very sense of moral agency then becomes a further tool of imperialism, because it provides a moral sanction for Britain to intervene. And of course, the Protestant evangelical motivation for this is not something that sits easily with Islam, which is, you know, has a body of texts, of sayings, of prescriptions that, in the opinion of Muslims, derive directly from God. And so Gordon's understanding of God is written on his heart. It's experienced as a process of being born again. He reads the Bible, but he understands the Bible through that prism. For Muslims, there is this great body of law that for centuries and centuries and centuries has says that slavery is legitimate. And so there is, I mean, I suppose you call it a clash of civilizations. I mean, certainly a clash of moral perspectives.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think Gordon doesn't quite know, even at this stage. So this isn't the sort of fatal trip to the Sudan. This is a much earlier one. Yeah. But even at this stage, there's this sense that he doesn't quite know what he's getting into.
Well, he's going as Governor General of the Equator, isn't he?
Yeah, so it's a slightly weird story.
Slightly further down.
So basically, one of the Khedive's ministers, who's a guy called Nubar Pasha, he meets Gordon at a dinner party in Constantinople. And he's impressed by him. And he asks somebody afterwards, who is that? And somebody says, oh, that's Chinese Gordon. Don't you know who he is? And he gets a book about him, and he reads this book written by a French royalist, which says, oh, what a tremendous person Gordon is. And the minister says, oh, this is the kind of person we're looking for. You know, let's get him in to come down. And at first, Gordon's, as you say, just sent down to what's called Equatoria, which is kind of now South Sudan, North Uganda. So it's the bottom bit of the Sudan. And that's the bit that basically the Sudanese slave hunters prey upon. They are looking for kind of black African slaves that they will send north and east and so on.
Which, again, they've been doing since the 8th century.
But Gordon thinks this is unconscionable. He's there to stamp it out and in doing so, to reassert the power of Cairo. So he goes down and he ends up being given more and more power. So by 1877, 3 years after he's arrived, he's been made Governor General of the whole of Sudan. Yeah. That sounds like a very grand job, but basically he's doing it on his own with a handful of people kind of trudging around this colossal, colossal country. I mean, a country basically the size of Western Europe.
And kind of horrible. I mean, the conditions are unbelievably
They've got
tough.
Kind of so permanent dysentery. There's no water. That's incredibly hot.
Well, again, we've Lytton Strachey's biography of him, which, it's in so many ways so damning of him, so negative. And yet again and again, there are phrases that kind of are expressive of admiration. So Strachey describes Gordon in Equatoria, the confused and horrible country, the appalling climate, the maddening insects and the loathsome diseases, the indifference of subordinates and superiors, the savagery of the slave traders and the hatred of the inhabitants. So a kind of a grueling place for someone to be. And he's fascinatingly, I mean, from contemporary sensibility. So obviously his role in stopping the slave trade, I mean, you know, what's not to approve, really. But he's also very hostile to ivory trading.
He is, because a lot of the slave trade is driven by ivory. So they need people. There's a huge demand for ivory in the West. And a lot of the slaves are carrying loads of ivory to the coast.
Yeah.
And stopping the two kind of goes hand in hand. So actually, you know, Gordon's a conservationist hero as well as an anti-slavery one.
And he's worried that the rapacity for ivory will wipe elephants out.
And
a very 21st century perspective. So,
but he's a failure though, isn't he, ultimately? He's disappointed. He basically says, I can't rely on any of the Egyptians. They're completely corrupt.
Well, because the only way to stop the slave trade is to stop it at source. Is to stop the market. So he can try and, you know, basically he's kind of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Because you know, he'll close off one avenue and another one will sprout up. You know, it's got to be, he recognizes it's got to be stopped in Arabia and Constantinople or whatever, that that's the only way to halt it.
Yeah. And he's a very, something quite forlorn about him, I think, at this point. You know, he as you say, he's in terrible conditions. He's very lonely. He's reading his Bible for 3 hours a day to kind of console himself as he's sort of riding his camels around the Sudan or taking ship down the Nile or whatever. And then he basically resigns, doesn't he, at the end of 1879, early 1880. He says, I've had enough. I'm out. You know, I'm not getting the support I need. But that's helped to make him even more of a celebrity, the fact that he's basically been running a country, a massive country. So then Leopold II, this Belgian bad guy, I'm sorry to say, asks him to come and run the Congo for him.
That but hasn't he before first... that, hasn't he gone off to be private secretary to the Viceroy of India?
Yeah, I think he had an opening offer from Leopold. Leopold keeps asking him.
Okay.
But he does go to India, you're right, as the private secretary of Lord Ripon, who's the Viceroy, and he hates it, absolutely hates it, and he resigns after
So he arrives days. In Bombay with the Viceroy after on the kind of a week, and
yeah.
a Zoroastrian, a Parsi, hands over a book of poetry, and Gordon, as the private secretary, has to say, yes, the Viceroy will read it with great interest, but knows the Viceroy will never read it. And Gordon is so tormented by having to lie about this that he resigns.
Yeah, he's a very intense person. Yeah. I mean, he's not the person you would employ as your PA, basically.
Not the kind of person who you'd employ as a spin doctor in Downing Street, certainly.
No, that's definitely true. He wouldn't laugh about illicit parties.
No,
he wouldn't.
Well, he hates dinner parties. I mean, that's the other thing.
Well, he says, when he's in Khartoum at the end...
People constantly asking him to dinner parties.
When he's in Khartoum at the end of his story... He says, you know, one of the great things about being here is I don't have to go to any dinner parties.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. When is the famous thing where he meets up with a French guy who takes him to the opera house in Naples?
Oh, I didn't see this.
Where they see female ballet dancers. And Gordon's so appalled. He says, if this is civilization, it can go hang.
You can keep it.
And then according to the Frenchman... He comes round to see Gordon later, and Gordon is kind of sitting there with his trousers open, lying on the bed, drinking, necking brandy.
I don't believe that's Rudolph Giuliani, surely, from your description.
Well, it's a guy called Joseph Reinach,
who
at the time was very enthusiastic about Gordon, but then 30 or 40 years, and this then...
We haven't really mentioned the issue about Gordon and drink. So there are stories that were put about later on. We had a question, actually. One of our listeners asked us a question. Man of Gwent says Winston Churchill wrote of Gordon. Of course, there is no doubt that Gordon as a political figure was absolutely hopeless. He was so erratic, capricious, utterly unreliable. His mood changed so often. His temper was abominable. He was frequently drunk. And yet with all that, he had a tremendous sense of honour and great abilities. I mean, Churchill's basically talking about himself, isn't he?
Yes, very much so. But you know where Churchill got that from?
From Lord Cromer, Evelyn Baring.
Sir Evelyn Baring, who was basically the guy who's running Egypt.
Yeah, and who hated and who Gordon.
Hated Gordon. So Baring is the source for a lot of the stories that, I mean, actually most of the stories, that that Gordon was a drunk and an alcoholic. And also that he perhaps wasn't entirely all that he should have been sexually. So Baring said of Gordon that he was a queer fellow with a very feminine side to his character.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yeah, yeah. Baring can't really be trusted, I think. And a lot of Gordon, I mean, Gordon wasn't a drunk. I think you can reasonably say he might sometimes have, you know, in stressful situations, necked a bit of brandy. But I think...
He was drunk with the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, well, I think by and large, most of the people who worked with him said, no, I don't think he was a drunk. I didn't see him drinking to excess. So I think we can probably put that one to bed a little bit. What is true is that Gordon, as time goes on... Particularly because he's in these incredibly stressful situations. He is a bit cranky, isn't he?
And he's alone with his Bible and he just keeps reading the Bible
and making up his own strange ideas. So having he's been to the Sudan, where else? I can't remember.
South Africa, he goes.
He's been to South Africa.
He meets Cetewayo, doesn't he?
There's this strange point where he goes to Mauritius with the Royal Engineers. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
He goes to the Seychelles, to one of the islands of the Seychelles, where they have these sea coconuts, these double coconuts called Coco de Mer. And Gordon becomes convinced that the trees with the sea, with the double coconuts, are the tree of the knowledge of good and evil from the Garden of Eden. This, he thinks he's found the Garden of Eden, because he says these double coconuts, if they're attached to the tree, they look like the male organ of generation.
Yeah, brilliant.
And if
stuff.
You cut them open, they look very much like the female organs of generation. So these clearly are what Eve and the serpent were getting stuck into or whatever.
So you can imagine you're getting telegrams about this in the residency at Cairo.
Well, he tells people this. This is the thing. Yeah. So the governor of Basuto land, he told him, he said, he wrote, Gordon is as mad as a March hare. He's certainly a military genius, but about religious matters, he is quite mad. And yeah. And clearly, even Gordon's admiring biographers say Gordon was going around telling people this. Yeah. You know, stiff kind of Victorian, worldly kind of governors and generals and stuff. And they're just absolutely bamboozled by it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also he then goes to the Holy Land, doesn't he? And
he finds Golgotha, doesn't he? He thinks he's found
so
Golgotha.
So he claims, yes. And you can still see it actually in Jerusalem. So it's the tomb in the garden. So it's not the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Right. It's basically called Skull Hill. Is it called Skull Hill?
Yeah, so it's outside the old city, up on the hill.
Is there any credence for Gordon's claim?
No, I don't think so.
Oh.
But I've been there. It looks more like you would hope it would look.
Right.
So he's doing all that. And also I think he's being mad.
That's harsh, Tom. That's a bit harsh. He's just spending too much time on his own.
Well, there's a lot of that stuff that you get, you know, where places in the Holy Land are kind of secret clues to lost civilizations, all that kind of thing. I mean, he is an 1880s version of those kind of books.
Yeah.
You know, Atlantis or Aliens or something like that. That's kind of what he's doing. But then in 1884, he, as you say, he signs up to go to the Congo as an agent for Leopold II, who is an out and out baddie.
It's really interesting, isn't it, Tom, to think how different this podcast would be if he'd then gone to the Congo, isn't it? I mean, our whole...
Well, he would... Leopold II is basically using Gordon to try and kind of Christian wash it.
Yeah.
Isn't he? I mean, Victorian hero, yeah. Wash it.
Yeah.
He wants him to go so that his, you know, what is effectively a private estate that will be brutally, brutally run. He's doing the same with Stanley as well, the American explorer. I don't think that Gordon would have tolerated
stayed there
that
long.
For a
no,
minute.
He probably wouldn't. Actually.
I mean, he's not the man to do that at all.
But he really thinks that he's going to go to the Congo and end slavery. I mean, this is the sort of strange, twisted, as you said, the sort of weird, contradictory nature of African, European high politics and diplomacy in the 1880s. That Leopold II tells Gordon, "I want you to come and we can end the slave trade together. You can end it in the Congo." What he really wants to do is to use Gordon as the front man for his operation, in which he will basically have Congolese slaves working for him.
Yeah, and I think Gordon is starting to rumble this before he goes, because there's he makes a comment, huge apologies to Bart van Loo and to all our Belgian listeners, but Gordon says, "I do not like Belgians."
Yeah,
and I think that's
Hercule Poirot.
Yes, I think that's because he's starting to feel that Leopold perhaps is up to a dirty one.
But he's been in Brussels, hasn't he? And then he comes home from Brussels in January 1884 when he's dithering about whether to accept this offer of going to the Congo. And he arrives in England to find a telegram from a journalist called W.T. Stead, who is the by far the most famous kind of muckraking newspaper editor of the day, this guy who runs the Pall Mall Gazette.
And he's also a very keen spiritualist. Do you know the story of his daughter and the ghost?
I don't. Would you like to tell me?
I'd love to. So their house was on Smith Square, which is where Tory Central Office is and now the European Union right. Embassy. So Stead and his daughter Estelle lived there. Stead then goes on to drown on the Titanic. But before he gets drowned on the Titanic, his daughter Estelle is, she's lying in bed. She gets woken up by a man who comes into her room, slams the door open, takes off his hat, sits down at a desk, begins writing, ignores her completely. And the same thing happens three nights in a row. And Estelle has no idea what's going on. Who is this strange guy who's wandering into her room and sitting down and writing? So the father suggests that they get hold of a spirit indicator, because the obvious solution is that it's a ghost. And this spirit indicator is a kind of device for communicating with the dead. So spirit Estelle indicator. Does that.
Sounds great.
And the spirit indicator reveals that this it is a ghost, and he's a chap called Gordon Knight, a minor poet who specialised in rollicking songs of the sea. And
like a sea shanty kind of yes. character.
And he and Estelle get on tremendously well. And they're great pals. And they have a lovely time. And the ghost stops slamming the door. You know, he behaves very irresponsibly. And Wednesday then drowns in the Titanic. The ghost keeps her in touch with her dead father.
And he keeps in touch with Stead.
So the ghost is the intermediary. Seeing Stead, who's dead, because he's now drowned in the Titanic. And so he then comes and reassures Estelle that her dad's okay.
Well, that's nice.
So it's a very happy story.
Did Estelle and the ghost keep in touch for the rest of Estelle's life?
I don't know.
Wow, that's an unexpected byway of the John Gordon story.
Well, but I suppose in a way it isn't, because it does show that people are believing quite a lot of odd stuff at this point.
So Stead says to Gordon, "I'd really like to talk to you." So Gordon, I think the day after he's arrived, or a couple of days, says, "Yeah, fine, all right, we'll meet up for this interview." And at the interview, Gordon gets out a map of the Congo to show Stead all his plans for the Congo. And Stead says, "Well, I'm not interested in the Congo. Are you not keeping up with, you know, the big news is the Sudan?" So basically, it's all kicked off in the Sudan. Egypt has been embroiled in a nationalist uprising, which the British have helped put down. And in this sort of general sort of chaos and fragmentation of Egypt, and also in the huge disruption in the Sudan caused by the attempts to suppress slave hunting and the slave trade, there has begun this great Islamist uprising.
That's what we call it now, isn't it?
Exactly. Under a guy called Mohammed Ahmad, who basically says, "I am the Mahdi." Now, Tom, you will know far better than me what all this is about, the Mahdi business.
Well, it's this idea that there's a kind of succession of significant figures who will, in the long run, herald the second coming of Jesus and the end of the world. And it kind of has the same kind of apocalyptic expression that you get with the Islamic State.
Or the Taiping Rebellion.
Yeah, but this is... Yes. But this is... It's Islamic.
Yeah,
and so it's expressive of that kind of same yearning for an establishment of a perfect Islamic order that has been massively, massively enhanced by the experience of Western power. And in a way, you know, the Mahdi is expressive of that in the same way that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the Islamic State in more recent years have been.
We've talked about lots of similar things on this podcast, haven't we, Tom? Like the Taiping,
Ghost Dance.
Al-Qaeda, the Ghost Dance, exactly, in the United States.
I think that Taiping, jihadism, I think we can legitimately call it that, in the 19th century, the Ghost Dance, all of these are expressions of a kind of spiritual anguish in the face of the power of the Western empires. And it's an anguish that different societies evolve different ways to cope, you know, how you deal with it. And in the Muslim world, Islam has remained, you know, the great wellspring for yearnings and kind of dreams of ending Western intrusion and authority and power right the way up to the present. So that's why, you know, we said, I think in the first episode, that this is a punctuation point in the story that leads from Napoleon's intrusion into Egypt, which we've done an episode on, right the way up to the story of 9/11 and its aftermath. And because Gordon does not think that the Mahdi is religious.
That's the fascinating thing. He's so religious himself, but he says to Stead, "Well, the Mahdi's not really a religious figure." I think basically because Gordon is so fixated on ending the slave trade, and he knows that there's a lot of discontent in the Sudan about that from the slave hunters. So I think he thinks that the Mahdi is merely the sort of figurehead for a local uprising against the Egyptians, you know, fueled by kind of slave hunters. And he thinks, if I can get, if you can sort out their grievances, then the Mahdi will kind of go away. I think that's what he thinks, isn't it?
It will provide an opportunity to get back to Khartoum, and perhaps with British muscle behind, then we can crack on with suppressing the slave trade.
Yeah. Well, this gets so confused, doesn't it? And strange, this kind of story.
Okay, well, I think we should take a break there. I think when we come back, we will look at the broader political context in Britain, which is quite complicated. And then we will go into the dramatic final year and final days of Gordon of Khartoum.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back. We are into the end game with our special on Gordon of Khartoum. And Dominic, we're gearing up to send Gordon to Khartoum a second time. Yeah. We're still in Britain. What's the political context for what is happening?
So Britain has a Liberal government under Gladstone. The Liberal Party is a kind of a very strongly anti-slavery party. But it's also a non-interventionist party in many ways compared with the Tories.
So again, it's kind of like people who are very against military intervention, NATO's military intervention in Afghanistan, but also are very much in favour of stopping the Taliban from approaching.
Exactly. So there's a real ambivalence there. Gladstone doesn't like the idea of sending armies to overthrow regimes and so on. He's a bit ambivalent about that, not least because it's expensive and Gladstone's all about kind of keeping costs down. But there are people in the Liberal Party who think, there are some who think, you know, we should definitely shore up the Egyptian regime, and shoring up the Sudan is part of that. There are some who passionately want to end slavery and see it as an opportunity to do that. So while they're all sort of debating, what are we going to do about the Sudan, where there's this big uprising, this sort of, as you say, jihadist uprising, and the Egyptian regime wants to do something about it. While they're doing that, W.T. Stead publishes his article. His interview with Gordon. The interview is called Chinese Gordon on the Sudan. And there's an accompanying editorial entitled Chinese Gordon for the Sudan. Yeah. Instead, basically says, I've interviewed Gordon. He's clearly the man. Send him immediately. He'll sort it out. And boys, newspaper boys, are sort of shouting these on the streets of London. All the other papers pile in, say, yes, 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 send Chinese Gordon. He's the man.
And so this is the British tabloid press.
The tabloid press, except, well, the equivalent of the tabloid press, absolutely kick, you know, sort of stir this up. Now, you mentioned, I think, in our first podcast about Gordon's great mate, Garnet Wolseley, who he'd become pals with in the Crimea. And Garnet Wolseley is the number two man in the army to friend of the show, the Duke of Cambridge,
yes,
who is totally
the most
useless,
incompetent commander-in-chief ever.
So Garnet Wolseley despises the Duke of Cambridge. Wolseley is Britain's top general, but he wants to really run the army himself. He's got a whole network of other generals called the Wolseley Ring around him who are kind of modernizers and so on. I think, and I think quite a few historians take the view, that Wolseley wants to use Gordon to go to the Sudan. He wants to send Gordon to the Sudan and then go and rescue him. That's mm-hmm. always Wolseley's plan. He's always thinking, this will be a great opportunity for us to, you know, use the army to go and sort
And is Wolseley doing that? What's his motivation for that?
It'll make his name. It'll allow him to cement his control over the army.
Over Sudan? I mean, is it a kind of empire building?
Nobody wants the Sudan for the Sudan. There's nothing there that people want. There's no, I mean, the only, later on,
the French and the British want
Sudan to complete the jigsaw puzzle of their European, of their African empires. But nobody wants it for that reason at this point. I think it's more about prestige and status than anything else. Okay. So basically, Wolseley helps to persuade the Liberal government, not Gladstone, because Gladstone's away, but
Gladstone's private secretary, W.W. Yeah. Hamilton, he seems to be a half-cracked fatalist.
Yes,
before Gordon's even gone.
Yeah, lots of Gladstone's people say, sending Gordon is absolutely demented. He's the worst possible person you could send because he's all about the Garden of Eden and stuff these days. And also, he doesn't follow orders. You know, he's reading his Bible and making up his own mind, and he doesn't do as he's told. But he gets summoned to the War Office on the 18th of January, and there are four different cabinet ministers there. There's Lord Hartington, there's a guy called Sir Charles Dilke, there's Lord Granville, Lord Northbrook. And they basically say to him, well, we've heard you're the man, are you going to go to the Sudan and all this sort of thing? Now, what?
Was Churchill there then?
No, that's my generic. Well, Churchill was a liberal. He's a senior liberal minister too, Tom, only a few years later. That's just a generic late Victorian Edwardian minister's voice. Okay. Hello, Gordon. Come in. Sit down. Cigar. But anyway, there he goes. There he is. What's not clear is what they tell him to do. So they think they've told Gordon, go to the Sudan and
fight them on the beaches.
No, they say, find out. It's a fact-finding mission only. So they think that he's going to go and report back on the situation. What's going on in Khartoum? Report back. He seems to have thought that it's his job to evacuate the Khartoum garrison and everybody in Khartoum and get them out before the Mahdi arrives. But what also seems to be the case is that at some point in his mind, the idea takes shape. He could just go down there and run it.
Yeah.
And some people think he gets that idea later, but some people think he had that idea from the very beginning. That he basically thinks, I should be in charge from the start.
But it's floating around in London even before he leaves, because there's a Tory peer who says of what Gordon is planning to do, since the days of knight errantry, never was such an expedition taken.
Yeah.
So there's clearly all kinds of different perspectives on what's going to happen in London, just as maybe there are in Gordon's head.
That's the thing. Nobody really has ironed out why Gordon is going and what he's going to do. And what is going, you know, what they're going to
but
do
could
once
you not
he
also,
gets there.
Could you not, would it be going too far to say that the uncertainty reflects the massive kind of moral uncertainty that Britain feels about what the purpose of the British Empire is? Does the British Empire exist to do good, to suppress slavery, to stop elephants being wiped out, or does it exist to stop the French from occupying territory, or does it exist to serve the interests of realpolitik and ensure that the Egyptian government stays in place so that they continue to screw it of money? Maybe all those things. And
yeah, I think that's
in a
fair
sense,
point.
Gordon is, he's such a loose cannon.
Yeah.
That maybe this is why it has the impact that it does, because his expedition focuses all the tensions and ambivalences and contradictions that are that British imperialism, particularly in Africa, is generating.
But not just British imperialism, right? I mean, do you not think there are elements of this when you think about our podcast that we did about Afghanistan?
Yes.
We've talked about the 9/11 and the
I'm just saying specifically Africa, because because slavery is so important to the story.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And the anti-slavery thing, by the way, will be a feature a little bit later, because there's an unexpected irony of this.
Mm.
Because of the anti-slavery cause, Gordon's not allowed to have the allies that he wants to have. Mm. But anyway, they've had this meeting. They sent a telegram to the Queen. We'd like to send Chinese Gordon. The Queen loves this idea, Queen Victoria. She thinks it's absolutely brilliant. She's a great Gordon fan.
Lots of underlinings in her letters.
She's like, absolutely hurrah. This is the best
thing. He's a marvellous man.
Yes. That was almost a bit of Margaret Thatcher there, I thought, Tom. it's absolutely marvellous. Right. So they take him. I mean, I think this story may be a bit apocryphal, but it's worth telling anyway, because it's such a good story. They're supposed to have taken him to Charing Cross Station basically that day and put him on the 8 o'clock mail train to the continent. You know, off you go. Go now. Lord Granville is reputed to have bought him his ticket. I think this turns out not to be true, but it's a good story. And the other thing is that Gordon had no money with him. He didn't carry money. So his mate Wolseley gives him his cash and gives him his gold watch. And they sort of wave him off. Off you go, good chap. You know, good luck. And suddenly, out of nowhere, Gordon, who was going to go to the Congo, is on his way to the Sudan. But he doesn't go straight there, which was the original plan. He stops in Cairo. And this adds another level of complexity, because when he gets to Cairo, he's brought in to see Evelyn Baring, who is the British agent in Egypt, who basically is running Egypt, and the Khedive, the ruler of Egypt. And they say to him, don't go to Khartoum to just evacuate the garrison or to do a fact-finding mission. Go to be governor general. Go and run it. And at that point, obviously, in his own mind, the meaning of his mission has changed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So a lot of people would say that's the moment at which the sort of the fatal melodrama, you know, is prepared.
We should also, I mean, you know, we said in the first part that there is a kind of a part of him that has always yearned for martyrdom.
Yeah.
So he's not afraid of death because death will lead him to heaven.
Well, he keeps saying during the course of this expedition, you know, things are absolutely going to pot around me and it's absolute disaster. But I can't question God's plan. This is what God wants. And it would be wrong for me to try to change anything or to escape or any of these things, because that's clearly not what God is intending. So I think by the way,
and that's
leaves,
very clear. The French guy whose name I can't remember, who also subsequently accused him of being drunk.
Yeah.
But says that he did, you know, what he did, he never did anything for political reasons. It was always for Christ and the Gospels.
Yeah, everybody knows that. And that's why quite a lot of people, when they say we're sending Gordon, are like, what? He's the worst person you could possibly send.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're sending a sort of, people sort of say you're sending this kind of evangelical Puritan to try to save the Sudan against the Mahdi. I mean, that's completely demented. The last person, Gordon's not a pragmatist. He's not realpolitik. He's none of these things. Anyway, off he goes. He goes on with his mate, Colonel Stewart, who's his sort of chosen second in command. They go south from Egypt, up they go up the Nile, by steamer, by railway, horses. He arrives at the second city of Sudan, which is called Berber, in February 1884.
Yeah.
And at that point, he's told the Mahdi's troops have basically cut off the route from the coast, from the Red Sea. So you can't evacuate Khartoum that way. Then you can't expect rescue that way. So the job is going to be much, much harder. But he says, you know, fine, we'll just keep going.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So they arrive at Khartoum on the 18th of February, 1884. And you, at the very beginning of this epic, you read out the thing from, he burns all the debtors' books.
Yeah.
And he sort of, you know, he
and
says
whips,
all,
doesn't he?
Yeah.
And the stocks and... So all this, the implements of torture.
He's a great performer. He's a great kind of political performer. And he arrives in Khartoum and he clearly sees himself. I mean, this is what Lytton Strachey brings out in his essay in Eminent Victorians, that he sees himself as a bit of a kind of very small M messiah of a kind.
Well, he's Christ clearing the temple.
But straight away, it's obvious he's not there to report back to the Liberal government in London. He's there for the long haul. So he starts to evacuate Egyptian women and children and European women and children by steamer. But he kind of settles into the palace. He walks around in his fez. He keeps saying, you know, this is all God's plan. So he writes, all things are ruled by him for his glory. It is rebellion to murmur against his will.
He's writing all this on telegrams as well, isn't he?
To
Bering.
So they're getting these telegrams. And they're like, what's going on?
Yes. So please advise estimated arrival on steamer. And then loads of quotations from the Bible. And yeah, I mean, not what you want, really.
But of course, but all the time this is being followed, you know, by the British newspapers. So they know that Gordon has gone. And they're like, what, you know, Gordon is the great hero.
We've got to rescue him.
Gordon.
Well, because then doesn't Stuart, he gets massacred.
Yes, he does. So a series of things start to go wrong. So first of all, Gordon has said, I want this guy called Zubair, who's a sort of a local chief, a warlord, basically. He is the man I need at my side to run the Sudan. Because I've been to the Sudan before and I know he has all the contacts. But Zubair is a slave hunter and a slave trader.
And also the father of someone who Gordon,
had killed. That is also a problem. Yeah. But the anti-slavery society in Britain says under no circumstances can he have Zubair, because Zubair is a bad guy because he's a slaver.
Yeah.
So the Gladstone is told by other liberal politicians, oh, it'll cause a lot of trouble for us with the liberal grassroots. So Gladstone says, well, he can't have Zubair. No good. So at that point, Gordon doesn't really have any local allies. And the Mahdi's army is closing in the whole time. And Bering in Cairo keeps saying to Gordon, well, you could evacuate.
Well, it's like the Taliban, isn't it? I mean, it's the reports coming back from Kabul saying the Taliban are closing in.
But what would the analogy, who would we send, or the Americans send to Kabul, that would be the equivalent of General Gordon? I mean, Tony Blair, if he'd gone personally, people would be saying, we must rescue Tony Blair before the
Who would it be? Who would it be? Meghan Markle.
Oh, my God, Tom.
Harry. It would be Prince Harry.
Would it be?
It would be someone like Prince Harry.
It's such a bizarre scenario. I don't know.
Well, because Prince Harry served in Afghanistan.
He did.
Yeah, I think that's the...
If we sent him to be Governor General... And also Prince Harry.
But also because he's been born again.
Yeah. Into oneness.
And he sees and he's, you know, he's refusing to come because he's got to save.
He's got to decolonize the Afghan curriculum.
He's got to decolonize the Afghan curriculum. Exactly.
That's the analogy.
I think that's what's going on.
Well, anyway, this situation has now got completely out of control. People are saying to Gordon, you could go north, you could go south, you could get out of Khartoum. And he's like, under no circumstances am I leaving. He says, I'm not going to leave Khartoum and leave people behind. Absolutely not. I'm here for the long haul. The Mahdi, so he's the leader of the jihad, he starts sending Gordon all these letters saying, why don't you surrender and embrace Islam? It'll be fine. You know, we can be great pals. And in the film Khartoum, with Laurence Olivier as the Mahdi,
Charlton
Heston.
Yeah.
Don't they meet up? The Gordon and the Mahdi actually
it's
meet
not
up.
Not a film that gets shown a lot these days.
No, because Laurence Olivier is blacked up, you see, to play the Mahdi.
Also, Charlton Heston as Gordon.
I think Charlton Heston is quite good as Gordon, actually, in the film. Anyway, that's by the by. So Gordon says, no, I'm not going to convert to Islam. You know, I'm still here. So, you know, the Mahdi's closing in.
And in Britain, more people are getting more and more agitated, and Gladstone is digging his heels in.
And Gladstone says, no, I'm not going to send a relief force. And then eventually he agrees he has to. And Wolsey gets what he's always wanted, which is the chance to lead the rescue, but much too late because Gladstone has delayed and delayed. So the Wolseley expedition only arrives in Cairo on the 9th of September, 1884. So at this point, Gordon has been in Khartoum for, 7 months or so. But... at this point, the Mahdi is really quite close to Khartoum. So, you know, Gordon has had to put chains across rivers, and he's basically formed the people of Khartoum into a kind of defense. He's giving them little metal stars for good conduct and so on. He's running the whole thing as a kind of military operation. A month after Wolsey's landed in Cairo, the Mahdi arrives outside Khartoum. And then you have this, you know, for day after days and days and days, the dervishes, as they were, the British called them, the Ansar, I think, as they called themselves, the Mahdiist army, they're bombarding Khartoum with cannons and rockets and so on, and sort of rifle fire and things.
And then the waters drop, don't they?
They do. So it's all, so as you know, that it suddenly gets to the point where, like, okay, this is really serious now. If the British don't arrive, you know,
now,
Gordon is doomed. Gordon is up there on the roof of his palace, reading his Bible, writing letters, constantly writing, you know, God's will be done and all this. Yep. Thank God I don't have to go to any dinner parties, all this kind of stuff.
I wonder how the Wangs are getting on.
Yeah, the people of Khartoum have been reduced to eating dogs as the you know, it's all going horribly wrong. The British are coming south on, I think, the 17th of January, 1885. The British fight the sort of vanguard, the advance guard. So the British have come in this long, long column. They have to come so slowly because they need water and they need supply. They can't, you know, outpace their supply train. So it's taking forever. It's taking months. They fight the Mahdiists at a place called Abu Klea, but their commander is killed. This is the place, Tom. You know the poem that we read out in the cricket episode, my favourite poem.
Oh, about the play up and play the game.
Play up and play the game, Vitae Lampada. So the square that broke, the colonel's dead, you know, the all that sort of stuff. This sort of great poem of empire that's written about this battle. The square broke and, you know, there's all carnage. So they're going very slowly now, the relief force. Then on the 25th of January, I think it is, Gordon's up smoking on his roof, reading the Bible. But down below, the Mahdiists have identified, as you said, the waters have receded. And they've identified that a ditch has been left undefended or something. They can see a weakness in the defences. And first thing the next morning, the 26th of January, 2 days before Gordon's birthday, they break into Khartoum. And what follows is utter, utter carnage. Thousands of people being massacred, being beheaded, all Europeans basically being killed.
One of them is Gordon.
Well, we don't know what happens to Gordon. So the famous story...
Well, we know he got beheaded.
We know that, but...
And we know he died.
We don't know how. And the image that became one of the absolute defining images, not just of Victorian Britain, but of European empire, I would say, and the relationship between Europe and Africa, Asia, and so on, is George William Joy's painting, which you can see online if you don't know it, of Gordon standing there, imperturbable, in his fez, in his suit, on the steps of the palace, and this sort of great crowd of dervishes with spears facing him. And that's the image at the end of the Charlton Heston film, which recreates it to the letter. Charlton Heston looks... regal, you know, he looks splendid.
There are reports, aren't there, that he fights until he runs out of ammunition and then gets overwhelmed. But further complicating it, I mean, he's debating whether he should accept death, or if he gets captured, what should he then do? And he says that perhaps capture will be a kind of Calvary for him, a kind of...
What an extraordinary thing to be thinking, though, Tom, isn't it? To be weighing up in your mind.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some accounts, aren't there, that
Well, the Mahdi wanted him alive.
He did. There's one account that Gordon bared his breast to the dervishes and shouted, "Strike," and one of them plunged a spear into his chest. Yeah. I mean, there are numerous
different versions. But we know he does die against the Mahdi's wishes, who wanted him captured, and he does get beheaded, and the head gets taken to the Mahdi.
Yeah, and the body is thrown down a well, I think.
And never gets found. And 2 days later, the British steamers turn up outside Khartoum.
2 days, Tom. That's all.
And they don't even land, do they? They just...
No, they arrive and they realise. And Wolsey's great expedition, he's called home. He sends a furious, furious telegram to Queen Victoria and blames Gladstone for the whole thing and say Gladstone.
Well, so Gladstone, the grand old man, the GOM, gets inverted to become MOG, the murderer of Gordon.
I mean, when the news reached Britain, there was a Princess Diana style.
And around the world, I think.
Explosion. I mean, am I not right in thinking that there were signs with black borders in Boston and New York and so on, all around the world.
Even in Germany and
You know, that Gordon, the hero of Christian Western civilization, had been abandoned and betrayed and left to die in Khartoum, killed by the dervishes. You know, it's a story that could have been dreamed up by the
enemies of slave traders, and so many knots of paradox and complexity. And then further adding to that is then what happens in 1898 when...
Yeah, the British return.
The British return and wipe the Mahdi's army out at the Battle of Omdurman on the other side of the Nile from Khartoum.
Which Churchill is present at. Churchill writes about Omdurman brilliantly, by the way, in his book, The River War, because he was with the 21st Lancers. So they think they're there. I mean, they're not really there to avenge Gordon.
That's what they're told, aren't they? They're there to stymie the French.
Yeah.
And isn't it right? So it's commanded by Kitchener, who'd known Gordon.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And after the battle, he opens up the orders and gets told, actually, it's nothing to do with Gordon. You've got to go and stop the French.
But Kitchener made a point of despoiling the tomb of the Mahdi. The Mahdi was dead by this point. Kitchener had the Mahdi's tomb kind of... you know, his bones destroyed or thrown into a river or something. And
as vengeance for...
Yeah. And who is it? Reginald Wingate, who was another one of the officers.
And Douglas Haig as well, wasn't it?
Exactly. He supposedly got hold of the skull of the Mahdi's successor, who was called the Khalifa, and he had it made into a cup. And he used to drink champagne out of it, Tom, on the anniversary of the Battle of Omdurman, every year until 1953.
Goodness.
Which is...
And they were able to do that, what is it, because we have got...
the Gatling gun, and they have not. But the shock of Gordon's death, the way in which he was turned into a martyr. So Robert Louis Stevenson said, England stands before the world dripping with blood and daubed with dishonour. And this sort of sense that Gordon was... He's not just a martyr. He's not a hero. He's a positively a saint. I mean, this is what
Christ-like,
quite genuinely Christ-like. I mean, so this is what Wolseley said. Wolseley, where are you? Wolseley said, "He is gone from amongst us, and I shall never know his like again. Indeed, many generations may come and go without producing a Charlie Gordon. His example will be one that fathers will hold up to their sons in England, and as long as any faith in God remains to us as a nation." And that we continue to be manly enough to revere the highest form of courage and devotion to duty. This is a letter to Gordon's brother. So long will your brother be quoted and referred to as the human embodiment of all manly and Christian virtues. And this was, I mean, widespread in Britain and the English-speaking world in the 1880s. The sense that Gordon was the embodiment of Western civilization and Christian civilization. Do you not think, Tom?
I do. And I also think that is then what gets reacted against, most famously by Strachey.
And yes.
The last lines of his biography of Gordon, the future lay with Major Kitchener and his Maxim Nordenfeldt guns. 13 years later, the Mahdi's empire was abolished forever in the gigantic hecatomb of Omdurman. And then he has this... very famous last line. At any rate, it had all ended very happily in a glorious slaughter of 20,000 Arabs, a vast addition to the British Empire, and a step in the peerage for Sir Evelyn Baring. And I guess that would be the kind of default attitude now, that anything involving British military expeditions to, you know, up the Nile is to be viewed in those terms. But I think it is much more complicated.
Well, partly because of the slavery aspect, right?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, that
I think that you know, if we're saying, well, who are Gordon's heirs today in contemporary Britain? I mean, they're to be found among people who are campaigning to return looted artifacts to Nigeria and condemning slavery and campaigning to save wildlife in Africa, as they are among, you know, the more jingoistic, perhaps.
But Gordon would be a complete liberal interventionist, wouldn't he? I mean, he would be, you know, we should be in Afghanistan protecting women from the Taliban.
Yes.
He'd be all about that, wouldn't he? They're yes. really his heirs, I would say. People who yes. look at, you know, other parts of the world and say, we have a duty to bring them into the light, I would say. That Christian motivation, is which might be secularized now, but is absolutely there in kind of lots of Western societies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's why it's such a fascinating topic. And I thoroughly commend you
for having picked on
it.
So that's General Gordon. Shall I take us out by reading?
Yeah, because I feel very bad because you sent the poem to me and I enjoyed it so much that I said, could I read it? And I've read five of the verses and I know that you were dying to. So why don't you take us out with the last
few verses? Okay. Yeah. I won't do it in my Scottish accent, my McGonagall accent, because I think that would be disrespectful.
Well, please, just
to
don't
General
do it
Gordon.
In your inverted commas Churchill.
Oh, indeed, and yeah, well, I could do it in your Neanderthal voice, I suppose, but that would be that definitely would be disrespectful to General
Gordon.
Very disrespectful. Okay, here we go. He was always willing to conduct meetings for the poor. Also meat and clothing for them he tried to procure. And he always had little humorous speeches at command. Well, that's not true. And to hear him deliver them, it must have been grand. In military life, his equal couldn't be found. Not if you were to search the wide world around. And 'tis pitiful to think he has met with such a doom by a base traitor knave while in Khartoum. Yes, the black-hearted traitor opened the gates of Khartoum, and through that the Christian hero has met his doom. For when the gates were opened, the Arabs rushed madly in and foully murdered him while they laughingly did grin. But he defended himself nobly with axe and sword in hand. But alas, he was soon overpowered by that savage band, and his body received 100 spear wounds and more, while his murderers exultingly did loudly shriek and roar. But heaven's will, 'tis said, must be done, and according to his own opinion, his time was come. But I hope he's now in heaven, reaping his reward, although his fate on earth was really very hard. I hope the people will his memory revere, and take an example from him, and worship God in fear, and never be too fond of worldly gear, and walk in General Gordon's footsteps while they are here.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.